Genesis 1975 to 2021, the Phil Collins years, follows the previous, the highly definitive claim, Genesis 1967 to 1975, the Peter Gabriel years. The new book is the definitive biography of the world's greatest rock bands after the departure of Peter Gabriel. Here to talk to me about it today, live from somewhere in the UK, is Greg Sproston. Greg, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, my friend. Whereabouts in, I presume you're in the UK or somewhere. I can't say because it's...
Yeah, no, I'm on the south coast in Bournemouth, where it's quite sunny, actually, surprisingly, but not as warm as where you are at the moment.
Well, you know, we can match you for the sunshine, but there you go. It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because Genesis, if you think about Genesis in the Phil Collins years, and if you were a certain vintage, you think the 80s, you think, you know, Invisible Touch, I Can't Dance, all that sort of thing, and you think of Genesis as this big 80s commercial juggernaut, but the period of 1975 when Collins came out from behind the drums was a really interesting one for Genesis.
Yes, it was indeed. I think that's a very good point. I struggle a bit with the sort of mid 80s period of Genesis because they became a sort of commercial juggernaut, and I think the problem in doing that is they almost became owned by everybody in the whole world, and the rest of us that were sort of hardcore fans of their perhaps more interesting music, shall we say, felt a bit left behind. And what Mario's tried to do with this book and with its predecessor is to tell the whole story of the band, so that it's not just the kind of days when they were sort of stadium filling act. It's about the music, it's about the stories behind the songs, and it's about all of the sort of interesting stuff that happened across the whole of their story, rather than just those kind of big commercial blockbuster years.
And for people who are scratching their heads, going, "Who's Mario?" It's Mario Giamatti, and I hope I've got that correctly. And he's the he's the author of the book, and you presumably sort of put it into some sort of shape, or what was your involvement with it?
Yeah, so Mario is a very high-profile Italian music journalist. I've known Mario for, I don't know, maybe 20 years or so, and he's written a number of books in the Italian language on Genesis, and many, many years ago he asked me if I knew any book publishers who might help him get the books published into English. And a couple of years ago I started my own book publishing company. The very first books that we decided to publish were two volumes by Mario on Genesis. So we've translated them and made them available to the English audience for the first time. And Mario is, I don't know if you've heard of a guy called Armando Gallo. He was the original Genesis biographer back right. In the 70s. And he published a very famous book on Genesis called I Know What I Like. But Armando's kind of left the field a bit, and Mario is now the sort of preeminent musicologist behind the Genesis story. And Italy was the biggest, and earliest market for Genesis. It's where they really took off. So the fact that it's an Italian telling the story is a good thing. It's the right thing for me.
Why do you think that was? Italy was such a big market for Genesis. Was it because you know the lyrics during Gabriel and you know following on until we hit the commercial juggernaut? They were quite involved. They were lyrics. They weren't words. It was lyrical.
Yeah, it was. It was actually very lyrical music. It's a good point. And I think Italian audiences, well, A, they're very passionate. B, they obviously got their own sort of classical operatic background. And I think when you get bands that were beginning to try to, forge two different sort of musical backgrounds, which is what progressive rock tried to do, they fell for Genesis and other English prog bands like Van de Graaff Generator very deeply, you know. So, I mean, there's some great stories in the Peter Gabriel years of Genesis gigs where there were riots, you know. It was that intense. The audience was just completely overwhelmed with the whole experience of the band and Peter Gabriel's masks and all that sort of thing. And they were, you know, they'd be breaking barriers down to get into the venue. So it was a real hot spot. And in fact, Genesis, prior to this new tour, which is coming up somewhat surprisingly in the next few weeks, the last show in Europe they played was in Rome, and that was reportedly to 500,000 people.
Wow.
So that's how big the Italian side of the Genesis story is.
Now, we've had sort of bands, you know, the lead singer leave before. I mean, especially in the world of sort of heavy metal, sort of you think in your Deep Purples, your Rainbows, all that sort of thing, your Tulls, yeah. Like that's prog rock. And then somebody comes forward, but it's normally a guitarist or they bring somebody else in. It's not normally, with the greatest respect to that most noble of instruments, it's not normally the drummer. I mean, what happened there then?
Steady now, don't diss drummers. They're very,
dissing drummers. They're normally behind me, and she's normally got a whole range of stuff to bash me with. But I mean, that's right.
It's that's one of the most interesting bits of the book for me. It is this story of Phil, you know, coming from the back of the stage to the front of the stage, and there's this kind of narrative that Phil was kind of plotting at the back of the stage to, you know, become the front man. It was not like that at all. And what Mario was able to do was to track down the person that they expected to take over from Peter Gabriel. It was a guy called Mick Stickland. And he was all set to do the role. They auditioned him. They brought him in then to sing some of the songs which had already been recorded for A Trick of the Tail, and they were in the wrong key. His voice just didn't suit the key of the songs. So someone just said, Phil, just, you know, come and have a go. And there was a bit of concern that he'd be able to sing the more, you know, the more weighty numbers. But he nailed them. And, you know, and it's an extraordinary story. And even then, I think there was some thought that they'd get a singer in after the album had come out, you know. And Phil, bless him, and he's quoted in the book, he wanted Genesis to carry on as an instrumental band in 76. You know, he just wasn't into that kind of frontman thing at all. So, and on the first, on the Trick of the Tail tour, again in the book, you'll read about Mike Rutherford introducing some of the songs, because just to take that pressure off Phil from being the frontman. It's hard to think now, you know, with Phil, the kind of artful dodger that he is and all that stuff, that he was such a reluctant kind of to come forward from the back of the stage.
But it's interesting, you know, artful dodger, because people may not know, but you know, Phil Collins had that sort of stage school education. He wasn't he was used to creeping the boards. I mean, it wasn't as if he was, you know, a drummer who'd been in the back of the van then came forward. You know, he'd been used to performing, and so yes, it might have been a big call and a brave call to go and do this, but he had a theatrical background to fall back on, perhaps.
Yeah. I think very quickly he became a natural, and I think that theatrical background was, put him in good stead to do that. I think the problem was the fact that he was replacing Peter Gabriel. So Peter Gabriel was an iconic frontman. He'd developed these. I mean, the story, again told in the earlier volume, is developing these masks and outfits and
giant daffodil. Of course, we know the giant daffodil is the most famous one, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. The daffodil, you know, the fox's head, everything. So Phil, I think, was confronted with not just replacing a singer, but replacing the prime focus of the live band. And it was, to be honest, it was annoying the musicians in the band a bit, because it got to a stage where everyone would just ignore the band and just go straight to Peter, thinking it was kind of his thing. It was all his doing, which wasn't the case at all. So I think that was the issue. And I know that Phil made the choice early doors to go, you know, I'm not going to do much dressing up. I'm not going to try and replace the theatrical aspect of it. I will just be myself. And him being a London boy, and, you know, that sort of stagecraft that he had, it came quite naturally to him. And certainly on the, I think the only tour that Mike Rutherford introduced any songs was Trick of the Tail. After that, it was left to Phil to get on with it, because, you know, he knew what he was doing.
And what was the reaction then from if you'd like, diehard Genesis? Because they'd always been seen, I remember sort of, you know, being at school, and it was always, you know, up at the sixth form college, it was always the upper six and the lower six who were into Genesis, because it was, as we said, it was lyrical, it was literary. And we had that whole thing, and you're thinking Trick of the Tail, you're thinking Selling England by the Pound. What was the reaction of, if you like, your more proggy Genesis fans to Phil coming in, and what happened in terms of the songwriting duties, and again, we talk about, you know, being a lyrical band, you know, was it more of a group effort? How did they react?
Well, the fans, I mean, dealing with the fans first, I think it was a masterstroke, really, because of course there was huge love for Phil anyway, being as part of the band. So they weren't faced with a situation. I mean, the parallel that I can think of in the prog world is when John Anderson left Yes and Trevor Horn came in. And whilst in some parts of the world he was accepted, in the UK, there was a lot of heckling. You know, it was not considered to be an appropriate replacement. Phil didn't have anything other than a lot of love from the audience. So, you know, yeah, that he would fluff a few bits and bobs in the early days, but there was nothing other than love for him. Phil wasn't really writing much back then. He brought in some of the kind of fusion-y aspects of the material. A track called Los Endos, for example, was driven by him with his sort of rhythmic playing, etc. But Banks and Rutherford and Steve Hackett were the sort of core songwriters. And of course, for the next two albums, Trick of the Tail and Wind and Wuthering, they're firmly progressive rock albums. You know, there's no point in saying anything else. You know, it wasn't like Peter Gabriel, the prog rock years, and Phil Collins, the pop years. It just wasn't like that. You know, they had a couple of albums that were absolute sort of classic prog rock records before they then started moving into And Then the Three and then later on into the sort of Invisible Touch years, where it got more poppy and shorter.
And it's interesting one because, you know, Phil comes in, we're talking, what, 1976, 1977, roughly. And then it's a really interesting period for all those bands who have been, you know, have come in the, you know, in the early 70s. And of course we have punk, which comes and explodes and sheds a hand grenade over the old rockers. And, you know, Zeppelin goes there of the merry way, and Purple and whatever go off and do their things. And then you've got New Wave come in, and you've got, you know, you've got the New York guys come in. You've got Elvis Costello and the modern British songwriters. And it's a difficult time for quote unquote the dinosaurs, although they're not that much older than the people that they're playing against.
No. That's a very good point.
And then you see that, you know, albums start to come out like Duke and also like, you know, Genesis, which is okay, it's a little later on, sort of 83, but you can see that they've rather than go, they kind of, you know, they move with the times, if you will.
Yeah, I think they adapted more successfully than any of the 70s bands, really. They were I mean, the story that Mario tells is quite interesting because they were out of the country for most of the time when punk started to really break through. And I think they were hearing about it, you know, on the grapevine because they were off on tour. And they were thinking, yeah, let's get rid of the dinosaur bands, not kind of realizing that included Genesis. They didn't kind of think of themselves in those terms. Of course, they realized later on that they did. But they had a song called Follow You, Follow Me, which your listeners will probably be very familiar with. It was their first kind of big radio hit. And that started to break them in America, and it started to open their eyes maybe to, you know, a different audience and a different way of doing music. And the funny thing with the Genesis story is that they, you know, again, we think of them in two halves, the pop half and the sort of prog rock stuff in the 70s. But in fact, in 67, they started as a pop band. You know, that's where they started. They wanted to be a pop band. Jonathan King was trying to develop them into a pop act and all that sort of stuff. So they kind of went in a 180 sort of full circle, really. Yeah. They went back to where they started and started to move back into pop, and they adapted and they survived and they thrived. And it's that, you know, that's the, to their credit.
You mentioned 1967, you know, when they began in 1967, because we're based in southern Spain, we are duty bound to have to mention Chris Stewart, who obviously was the original drummer back in school with her, who is now based in the Alpujarras and wrote Driving Over Lemons or whatever it's called and all that sort of stuff. And so every time mention Genesis in Spain, you have to say, oh, of course, and Chris Stewart's around. So if you're listening, Chris, good evening, good afternoon to you. I saw Genesis, gosh, 1989, 1990 when they played Malaga, and it was kind of that sort of juggernaut phase. Amazing live band, huge production in the big Malaga football stadium. How did the band, if you like, react to suddenly becoming, because, you know, they went down the, rather than trying to do, and this is a thought, you know, three minute punk songs from Genesis, that'd be a quite an interesting one for a start. But they were, if you like, they embraced, if you are the AOR, because they, we forget, the FM radio had come on in the States, and you had your REO Speedwagons, your Totos, and that was a, you know, we look at it back and now and think, oh yeah, AOR has been around forever, but it hasn't. And this was, and FM radio was a big thing, and they sort of got onto that, if you like. So how did the band react to getting more into the mainstream, if you like, and then Phil coming onto his own? And I don't want to go off down a Sussudio side alley here, but, you know, the massive hit was, because if, you know, mid-85, from that point onwards, we had Invisible Touch come out and Land of Confusion and the Spitting Image Puppets, which everybody remembers. And this must have been quite a shock, as well as, you know, Phil doing his own stuff.
Oh, it's an extraordinary period. I think they loved it. There's nothing other than a feeling in the book that, you know, we've really made it. Now, it's weird from my point of view as a musician. I feel that, you know, to really make it is to make a great album. But the other side of it is you want to be successful. And I think when they reached a stage where they were filling stadiums out and having top, you know, top 10 albums in the US and the UK, then they felt that they had really made it. So I think they love that period. One of the nice things about Mario's book is that he knows the band and he's interviewed them many times, but he is not uncritical when he feels that musically they allowed themselves, or the music suffered because of the success that they were reaching for. So there's, you know, in one paragraph of the book, you've got Tony Banks or Phil Collins saying, "Oh, I think Invisible Touch, the song, is one of the greatest things we've ever done." And then you've got the next paragraph with Mario just saying, "It's kind of tosh, really. You know, it's just throwaway."
I'm glad you said that.
Throwaway pop. I mean, I'm kind of paraphrasing there, but that's broadly where Mario is at it. But the interesting thing is, I've met quite a few people subsequently who got into the band because of Invisible Touch and then have gone back and explored. So I think there's this dichotomy between the two eras, but there's more crossover than we think. And it's not just the diehards that stuck with them. It's also some of the newer fans in the 80s that did go back and thought, actually, the early music is fantastic and lovely.
And it's funny, isn't it?
But no, they love success. They love being successful. You know, there's no shying away from it.
And the other thing is, of course, if you think about it, because they were sort of pilloried for being prog rock, and then they changed. And then, you know, if you can't get more 80s, as I said before, maybe Dire Straits than Invisible Touch and, you know, I Can't Dance and all that. And they became the 80s band that everybody's not got a thing about. And now they're back, and, you know, and Phil's not been, you know, he's not been in the best of health. So what do you think drives them to want to get out? Because they don't need the money.
No, they don't need the money. That's for sure. I think there's a slight feeling of unfinished business. I saw them in Prague in 2007 when that seemed to be the final tour, that sort of comeback tour. But for whatever reason, they still feel there's a little bit more to be said. I don't doubt that Phil's main motivation here is his son who's on drums. So Nick Collins is drumming here, and I think he's proud of his son, and he's giving him a bit of a leg up. And you know, it's an opportunity for Nick, who's already played drums on the Phil Collins tour, just to get involved in some deeper and more complicated music. For Tony and Mike, I think, you know, I think what Mike said the other day was, it's what we do, you know, it's what we've done for 50 years. And, you know, it just feels like it's what we should still be doing, really. But I don't doubt that we are at the end of the road, certainly from what Phil's demeanor is and the body language and from what he's saying in the interviews over the last few days, he is, you know, this is going to be it. So if you can get a ticket, I suggest you do, because, I think there probably won't be any more shows after the US leg of this tour, which is later in this year.
And you said that Mario had spoken to, you know, he's interviewed them, and he's, you know, he's got a healthy critical stance on it, and he spoke to, you know, former band members as well. I mean, did they look at the Genesis as a great experience to be involved in? But, you know, think, you know, we're quite happy we got out when we did, kind of situation.
Actually, that's a very interesting question, because you've got a couple of different characters in the book. Steve Hackett, I think, is still a little bit sore about things. I think he's sore because he didn't feel like he had enough of his songs being recognised and being brought into the band. But he's very successfully gone back to Genesis in recent years. I was at the Symphony Hall in Birmingham earlier this week and saw Steve Hackett play a predominantly Genesis show, and it was a very good turnout, considering gigs have only just restarted over here. So that's Steve Hackett. The other character in the book that's very interesting is Ray Wilson, who replaced Phil Collins briefly on that Calling All Stations tour. And he is... he comes over still quite angry, I think. He still feels let down. He's heavily quoted in the book. He feels let down by the Genesis machine. I think the thing with Genesis is that you've got the bandmates or the band members, but you've also got a very big organization around the management and all of that stuff. And I think he's annoyed at the management more than anything else. But yeah, he's... Again, there's some spicy moments in this book. It's the book is about the music predominantly. You know, we're not interested in gossip here, but there is some very spicy language, shall we say, from you know, band members or former band members that are a little bit unhappy with how things ended for them.
But nothing exists in a vacuum. So you have to have, if you want to understand some of the songs and maybe some of the lyrics, then you've got to have that backstory.
Hmm. Of course, and Ray himself he's in effect made a career out of, or has used the Genesis experience, which is only a couple of years of his life, to have a career in Eastern Europe. And, you know, he does a lot of work with Genesis songs still. So hopefully he'll look back on it more kindly. I don't know. But I mean, there's been some comment because the title of the book was my idea. And there was some comment of, you know, why is it the Phil Collins years, but when Ray Wilson was the singer for a couple of years? And it really, I think for me, Ray. Yeah,
yeah, Ray, if you want to shift copies, I think perhaps is, you know, the Phil Collins.
Well, exactly.
Might have a bit of tag,
I mean, that's
there,
exactly right. From the publishing side of things, it's about, you know, identifying the book very clearly. But I think with a career this long, Phil undoubtedly sort of dominated the second half in terms of being the front man and the drummer and the singer. So I think it was the right title.
The book is called Genesis 1975 to 2021, The Phil Collins Years. It's out now. It's by Mario Giacometti. It's been obviously aided and abetted, shall we say, by Greg Sports. But Greg, if people want to find out more about you, because you're sitting there in this rather splendid studio as we speak, where can they find out more about you and more about the book and what you do as well, mate?
Yeah, so two things I would say. I mean, Kingmaker's a new publishing house, so our social media isn't a huge presence at the moment. But there's a Twitter, we're at Kingmaker Books, or one word. But I'm also in a band called Big Big Train, and there's a lot more social media about Big Big Train than there is about Kingmaker Books. And if you will forgive me just for a little plug on
Go
Big
for
Big
it,
Train,
go for it, go
tour.
For it, plug it, plug
Thank
away, my
you.
Friend.
I appreciate that. We're on tour in the UK in March next year, and we're playing some pretty cool venues as well ourselves, like the Symphony Hall in Birmingham and the Palladium, etc. And the music that we play is it's in the tradition of 70s prog rock. So, you know, it's certainly, we owe a lot to Genesis. You know, they made some great music, and, you know, there are bands that are playing music in their tradition, including us.
Give me the name of the band one more time for an extra plug.
Big Big Train.
Big Big Train. Well, that's called Big Big Train. This is called Genesis 75 to 2021, The Phil Collins Years. We've been speaking to Greg Sproulton. Greg, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.